It's Jimbo Times. Okay, Jillian, seriously, thanks so much for joining me on this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast. It is so cool to be connecting with you, especially because you have been hard at work on this campaign trail. So really, my congrats and kudos to you and all your supporters. And please tell us more about you. Tell me about where you're coming from, and also when you first declared your candidacy for Council District 2.
Okay, great. Thank you for having me. So I'm Jillian Burgos, and I'm a proud Afro-Latina. I'm a small business owner of an interactive murder mystery theater company. I'm also an essential healthcare worker because you know how it is here in LA. We can't just work one job. For most of us, the reality is we have to work several jobs. And I'm also a lifelong renter who's faced housing insecurity much of my life. And finally, I'm a neighborhood council member. I serve on the NoHo Neighborhood Council and have served since 2021. I like to say that I am not a politician, but I feel that I have just been called to lead. I've felt this calling for a long time. And NoHo is actually my chosen home. I grew up in Ohio, and I am one of those people who in 2009, I bought a one-way plane ticket. I shipped all my stuff that I could and sold everything else off. And I had never visited here. And I moved here. And I think that was the best decision I've ever made. So I've deeply been invested in helping my community. And for me, I always was interested in you know, politics and helping the person you don't know, especially like after the 2015 Bernie Sanders Not Me Us campaign. He really inspired me, knowing that somebody was out there and knew exactly how I feel about how socioeconomic inequality is the greatest problem of our time. And that just really resonated with me. And I was just ready to run. And I'm like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to find the office that's right for me. And I'm going to change and help make like big change and help people. Then my mother, my strong, hardworking single mother, started showing signs of Alzheimer's. And being an only child, and she's in Ohio and I'm here in California, I think you can kind of see the problem there. So I had to travel back and forth for about 4 years because our healthcare system is not on our side. And I had to make sure she was safe. I had to protect her from financial predators. I had to make sure that she was getting the care that she needed and actually, you know, getting the diagnosis that she needed, because there's no blueprint for how to do this. And if it was not for the help of my family, my cousins — I have a ton of cousins, I'm Puerto Rican, so there's a lot of us — and if it was not for them, you know, I don't know if I could have done it by myself. And I mean, I didn't do it by myself. And so I got her safe. And then I started seeing family members losing their life due to like totally preventable circumstances. Like I lost my cousin Tony because he had a relapse, because we don't talk about mental health for men, especially. We don't talk about mental health at all in general. And he had one relapse. He left his wife and three beautiful children. And then I lost my uncle because he was a Vietnam vet and he saw the horrors and terrors of war, because we send people out to war and we don't bring them back the same way and we don't support them. And so, you know, he resorted to alcoholism because he didn't know how to deal, and died due to liver disease. And then the one that really got me was my cousin Yolanda Liz Dominguez, AKA Lala. Lala was my rock, and she really, really helped me. Anytime I was flying back, she would drop everything to be there for me. The only thing she asked me for was for a drink from Dunkin' Donuts. Her little latte was the only payment she ever wanted. And she really helped me. I really remember one of the things that I remember the most is the summer of 2019. Her and I were cleaning out my mom's room after we got her safe. And I said, you know what? I'm going to come back in the winter. I'm going to come back in December, and you and I are going to celebrate. And I didn't get that chance because she was gone in October. She was a severe asthmatic. Her public housing had black mold. They also deemed it a rampant crime area, so they blocked the entryway off. and she had a medical episode and the ambulance could not get to her on time. So that nearly destroyed me, losing her. And it took me a long time to be able to talk about her. But I realized, you know, I could let that destroy me or I could let that ignite me. And that way she wouldn't die in vain. And so I chose to let that ignite me. And then I decided I'm going to go ahead and run. And I ran for the NoHo Neighborhood Council and I got elected. And I became the treasurer and the chair of housing and services. And then I started seeing that on this basically advocacy group that I was making monumental changes in my community. I was able to pass grants that fed our unhoused neighbors, grants that gave mental health care to at-risk youth, grants that taught renters their rights so they wouldn't lose their housing. And I just realized that I could go further with this. I could take this to the city, especially after the LA Fed tapes. And so I decided to run for Los Angeles City Council District 2. And I declared running way early
right.
back in November of 2022. And yeah, we've been running a people power campaign ever since.
Wow. November 2022. That is right. I think that clearly you've been hard at work at this. And obviously the journey you describe is a very personal one. So you've had a very personal way towards this political world in Los Angeles that is rife for new leadership, that you probably saw a great need for as soon as you realized what rent looked like, not just for you, but for people in and around your community, including in North Hollywood, but also beyond. Now, to be sure about Council District 2, we know that it's home to, as you noted, North Hollywood, as well as neighborhoods such as Toluca Lake, as well as Studio City, Sun Valley, and more. But can you tell us a little bit of your own facts and figures about this place? Some facts and figures to keep in mind about CD2 for, say, a voter who maybe got a ballot just earlier this week and who's never voted before, but who is considering actually making their way out to the polls this time or sending a ballot in. What are some other things about CD2 that voters and folks in LA at large should know?
Well, you definitely, I love that you said somebody considering to vote, because CD2 historically has low voter turnout. And I really want to bring that home, that we need you to get out and vote. It's so important. Even if you've never voted before, it's, you know, it's something that is deeply important, especially because our community is 60% renters. And we all know that most renters are rent burdened. And we are also 43% Latino. So again, people who are rent burdened, who are hardworking, who are essential workers. A lot of people in the district are also entertainment workers. And if we know anything about 2023, three of the employers were all on strike at the same time. So right. We were really in trouble with, you know, WGA, SAG-AFTRA, and Kaiser on strike at the same time. So I think that if I would say anything, CD2 is full of artists, full of people who work with their hands and make something out of nothing every single day. And I'm so in awe of these people. And they deserve better. They have not heard from their council member. Their council member has been complacent since 2009. And I feel that the people of CD2 are hungry. They're ready for change. You know, everybody says that they want change. So this is the biggest opportunity that we have had, and we can have that change.
You also mentioned earlier that your time on the North Hollywood Neighborhood Council really led you to meet all kinds of folks from this community. And the Neighborhood Council system, for those who don't know, is a volunteer-led system. It also does contain funds for various projects in and around the neighborhood, one can say. And it really is a form of direct democracy. But you have served since 2021, and I'm curious, what do you think about that experience prepares you for public service in, say, the city council level?
Yeah. One thing about the neighborhood council systems, I don't know if you know this, but they were in place in 1999 because the Valley wanted to secede from LA. So I think a lot of people don't know that. And I think it's, you know, this was kind of a concession. The city's like, oh, we're going to give you a voice with the neighborhood councils. And so there are 99 neighborhood councils, but really probably about 75 to 85 of them are really active right now, especially since we've been made to go back into in person. I was elected during the pandemic, so I was used to Zoom meetings, and we actually had a nice following and it was really great. And then it kind of dropped off when we had to go back in person, but it's still, you know, I stepped in, I went head first, and I chaired many committees. You know, without having had that experience, it was really like a trial by fire. And I feel like now that's really prepared me to step into city government. So I chaired originally outreach, and then I chaired housing and services, which was the homelessness committee. On the very first day that I became chair, I changed the name to housing and services because homelessness is a housing issue, and I wanted to drive that point home. And I kind of got flack from that from people in the beginning. And, you know, it's just really like my favorite part about the neighborhood council system is talking to people in my community who have different viewpoints and educating them and learning from them as well, because they've educated me just as much. And I think that is building community in that way is so invaluable, and having that dialogue. But I also feel that, you know, it's allowed me to build relationships with some of the council member staff. And I've also had to complete a lot of the training that city council members do. So I think it's definitely prepared me for it. And I'd love to see how the neighborhood council system changes once I'm in office. I would love to help it because it's really been hurting. We currently have our budgets that have been cut. Originally, when the neighborhood council started, they were, you know, they had a $100,000 budget. And that was 25 years ago. And now the budgets are $32,000 a year. So we're not able to do as much for our community, but we make do with our council's really great. I love the NoHo Neighborhood Council. And we've been able to pass, like I said, grants that have better unhoused neighbors. I was just at a mural unveiling about 2 weeks ago, they called it the Tongva mural, but my community has educated me that they are the Keech people. And so I'm learning that, and I'm actually going to visit them next week and learn more about their culture. So I'm excited about that. And I think that's one of the biggest things, is that the community has reached out. I've taught them things and they've taught me things back. And it's a real true collaboration.
Yeah, big ups to the neighborhood councils out there and those volunteers who are really doing their best to serve their community at large, to meet as many members of the neighborhood as they can and see how they can collaborate in services together, given all the needs for this home of ours, the city of LA. Now, you had also mentioned that this experience led you to meet city council staff. I'm wondering a little bit about what coordination and what collaboration has looked like between the NoHo Neighborhood Council, for example, and Council District 2 since 2021. What's that relationship been like? What do they support with, and what can they do better at?
Okay. So we've had collaborations with, like I said, like the mural unveiling. We actually passed a grant for muralism to create that mural. And so we've supported them muralism on several different ventures. And I love them because they employ people in the community and people who are differently abled as well, in, you know, just are beautifying our community. So the council member's office has definitely helped with that. I think that we've really, our office is known for, I should say, our neighborhood council, we're known for writing the most community impact statements. And we get a lot of that from community feedback. A lot of it is, you know, wanting more affordable housing. I've definitely written a lot of those CISs or community impact statements. And I think, you know, we also during COVID, during the first part of the pandemic, I don't really believe we're out of it. We're seeing more waves. But during the first part of the pandemic, when we really didn't know what COVID was or how it affected people, we coordinated for vaccination workshops with the city. And so that was big. And actually, we worked with city, county, and state on that. So there was several offices coordinating to make sure that we had these successful workshops and that people who wanted to be vaccinated could. And also community events, a lot of community events, like for the children at our community center, our recreation center. So they're for pretty much most holidays, like Dia de los Muertos, for the any Christmas or holiday parties, we've had to coordinate with the council member's office there. And then for, you know, housing concerns, there's been a lot of housing concerns. We've had some landlords that have in our district that actually have been convicted of crimes. And we had to call in the council member's office to advocate for the tenants of those buildings. They've heard us. Have they went as far as I've wanted for them to help? No, they haven't. And that's why we have to keep the pressure on them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we mentioned earlier that about 60% of folks living in CD2 are actually renters. And there's data showing that some nearly that amount, 54% of those community members are actually rent burdened, meaning they're spending at least 30% of their income on rent. And that about a quarter of those renters are actually severely rent burdened. So can you tell us a little bit about how this affects basically every aspect of a person's life? Please educate us as to how rent burden and severe rent burden grossly impacts folks on an everyday level in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. I am severely rent burdened, and I have been for, like I said, for most of my life. If I did not live with my partner, I cannot afford to live here in the city of Los Angeles. And I actually make way above minimum wage. So for much of my life, I've had to work multiple jobs, live with multiple people just to survive. And it for a good, I don't know, almost 10 years of my life, I had to rent rooms in people's houses. I couldn't even afford my own apartment. I had to rent a room. And a lot of people live that way. A lot of people live that way. And it's stressful. So as you know, we were talking about the top employers in the district are studios. So we do have a high percentage of people who are out here to be actors, directors, writers. And as we found out with Hot Strike Summer, and that turned into Find Out Fall, it went on for so long. Many of the SAG-AFTRA members, actually, there was an expose that came out that they made about an average of $27 an hour. Now that's above our minimum wage, right? Our minimum wage is at $16 an hour. But that 27 still is not enough to survive. I believe you were talking to my friend Isabel Jurado, and you all were talking about, I think it takes about $42 is the average to actually be able to survive here in Los Angeles. So think about people who are our service workers. We have a lot of service workers. They're making $16 to $18 an hour. And then think about our SAG-AFTRA people who on average are making $27 an hour. And we're trying to get that holy grail of $42 an hour. So on top of that, for the SAG-AFTRA people, they have to hit a certain threshold in order to keep their insurance. Right. And they have like over 170,000 members, and actually only 12.7% of them qualify for their insurance plan.
Incredible.
And you know, that's a real problem. So people are starting to refuse vital healthcare services. I have a friend right now who's supposed to have surgery, and she has insurance. She is refusing to have her surgery at this moment in time because even after insurance, she's going to owe $9,000 after insurance. And I like to talk about a story that that happened to me in 2018. I had a car accident and the ambulance came for me. And I said, no, I said, absolutely no way. I'm not going in the ambulance. Even though I had severe soft tissue damage, I waited for my partner to come get me, because even with insurance, I knew a trip to the ER in that ambulance, that would break me. And so people are leaving District 2. Businesses, small businesses are leaving District 2. So we're not only like being, not only are the renters getting gouged, but the small businesses are getting gouged. We have several businesses that have closed just in the past 6 months that were beloved pillars of our community. We lost Teapot, which is an awesome cafe, tea-focused cafe, and was really just like a hub for the community. They featured new artists every month, and they had art fairs and community gatherings. And the landlord there, that commercial landlord, raised their rent 53%. 53%. And so they just had to pack up and leave. Like, they gave a 2-week notice to the community, and I felt gut punched that they were leaving us, because that was like my campaign manager and I like to joke that that was our unofficial office, because it's like really close to both of us. So if we wanted to have a meeting, we would run over there and you know, have a tea and talk stuff out. And now it's gone. And on that same block, three other businesses have closed because of the same commercial landlord. We've also lost Rodini Park, which was another great restaurant. Their landlord decided to, their landlord sold their building. And then that new landlord realized that the rent was way too low and then just upped their rent. And there's no rules to protect these people. And so, you know, think about that. There's a lot of artists that work in these service industry jobs. They're out of jobs. These businesses are closed up. We have so many vacant buildings, and you know, there's just something we have to do. We have to do something different. People are now moving away from District 2 and having to travel to District 2 to work. So we're causing more traffic. We're causing more stress. We're causing more pollution. And we really need to just do something to keep businesses here, to keep renters here, and to drive down these astronomical rents. The last thing I want to leave you with about why people, I believe people are so rent burdened, is illegal Airbnbs.
Right.
It's huge. It's a big problem here. I'm endorsed by City Controller Kenneth Mejia, and he comes out with just awesome tools, lots of information. And there's this one tool about the eviction notices, and I clicked on it, and I just randomly picked one luxury apartment building in the 91601 zip code by the metro. I randomly just picked this building. In September and October, they had 224 eviction notices. And then the next month, in November, they had 174. And I said, what is going on with this place? I went to their website, and on the website, they brag about being an Airbnb community. They said, oh, you want to go to New York for 3 months? Go ahead. We'll help you rent out your place. We are holding up really valuable apartments by doing this and driving up rents. You know, these corporate landlords are driving up the rents. They don't care about us. And they just care about, you know, they'll get somebody else, because everybody wants to live here in Los Angeles. And we need to do something to just protect renters.
Now, you have mentioned that you would actually look to regulate Airbnbs, that is illegal Airbnbs in CD2, but what are some tools that we could apply right away at the city council level for exactly this purpose? I mean, how do we get Airbnbs under control given the length of the housing units they've taken away from everyday renters such as yourself and myself out there?
Yeah. So there's already some ordinances that are supposed to be in place to stop illegal Airbnbs. And I think council member Nithya Raman actually mentioned about how hard it is to actually crack down on these illegal Airbnbs. And I think there's just a lot of red tape. We're not looking at it, and we're not focused on it right now because the homelessness crisis is so great. So we're focused on that. We don't realize like this is actually leading partially to the homelessness crisis. And yes, we have to have our eyes on it just as much. So I think we need to expedite the process to prosecute these people. We need to hold them accountable. And I really would love to implement a vacancy tax on commercial landlords. I think, you know, all these empty buildings, they need to be converted into housing. So on top of that, you know, I think that vacancy tax should increase the longer it is vacant, because we need to force them to turn over these properties. If you're not going to rent these properties out, sell them, get rid of them, give them to the community, give them to the city. So that way we could convert them into housing and actually get people housed.
Now, with respect to housing and actually getting it on the ground, we in this city talk maybe 90% of the time about housing and the need to build it faster and the need to build duplexes and triplexes and as much of the housing stock that we can get because we're nearly a million housing units behind by the last count. But what is it that we can do, given that folks say it's already difficult enough to build housing in the city of Los Angeles, so they've got low expectations that this can actually be implemented at a citywide level. Please educate us as to what happens when Jillian Burgos is in City Hall and it's the first year in office and you're ready to build. Tell us how that goes.
Well, first off, I want to say that with this election, we have a chance at monumental change because we have people who are housing advocates and who are renters and who are tired of the status quo. So we need to support these people. And that's definitely just the biggest thing that we can do because currently we have three people fighting for us on there. We have Nithya Raman, we have Eunices Hernandez, we have Hugo out there fighting for us, but they can't do it alone. We need that progressive majority. So we get Isabel Orado, we get Aura, we get myself, we get Serena on there. We can have that majority and we can keep pushing people. And, you know, educate the other council members to why this is important. There are some council members that do kind of jump on when they see the majority of progressive ideas, when they see that they've been educated on it. But I think, you know, really, we need to, Mayor Karen Bass did do one good thing with Executive Directive 1, which helped to expedite affordable housing being built. So if you want to build 100% affordable housing, we're going to cut that red tape and we're going to build it. But what she did is she changed it to take out single family zoning. Mm. And that's a problem there because we just can't build housing in one area. It has to be in all areas. And I understand that, you know, people love their single family housing neighborhoods. They're quaint. They're lovely. And yes, we might not build a huge high rise in your neighborhood, but maybe a duplex, a triplex. We have to be smart about it. And we can fit in a little like triplex with a courtyard that's very quaint and fits in nicely into the single family area. And then also then densely build around transit, which I think is one of the smartest things we can do is building there and, you know, cutting out the need for cars for a lot of people, because a lot of people here don't have cars. And hopefully we can encourage more people to have less cars in the future if we build housing around transit and build up our transit. That's another way we can help people. And if people don't have cars, they don't have insurance costs. They don't have car payments. They don't have to worry about fixing their cars, but we have to give them a reason why to give up their cars and to move to a less car-centric culture, which I think we are heavily car-centric right now. And we also need to build up the protected bike lanes to help them too, so that we give alternatives to getting in a car and adding to traffic and our pollution. But I think also, you know, just changing our, like I said, changing our zoning laws, going to a 15-minute city model where we have those businesses, those small businesses on the bottom, the housing on the top, and making sure that we don't forget the missing middle, because we've really pushed out our middle class. Our middle class is no longer able to survive.
Now, you mentioned transportation, and I think actually that the Valley, especially the East Valley, is really well positioned for an efficient public transit system that only gets better with time if it has true investment in it. I mean, the Orange Line, as I affectionately call it, is an incredible piece of work. And I think that clearly folks out there, when you incentivize them to ride public transit, they really take it all the way. So can you tell us a little bit about what transit justice in CD2 actually looks like for you, maybe 5 years from now and maybe 10 years from now in this council district?
It's equity for all people. So that means expanding our public transit. It means making it more reliable and making it fare free, because if it's fare free, more people are going to utilize it. We saw that during the pandemic. And to be honest, you know, all of these, like, the machinery, the technology used to collecting fares, the officers that are there to catch people who are evading fares, all of that makes Metro not profitable. So why don't we take that money instead and just make it free? Give it to the people, let the people use it. And when we see that more people are using Metro, you know, it's going to be safer. It's going to be safer. And also we should employ, I like the Metro Ambassador Program. Mm-hmm. I think that's really helpful. And it costs less than having LAPD out there. And people really love, you know, having someone who is enthusiastic about Metro and about where they're going and about their safety. And I think the Metro ambassadors are that. I think that when we see officers there, they don't want to be there. And they don't want to be there. They're standing around. They're not happy. And so let's take them out of there and put them where they need to be. And that's, you know, in situations that only officers can handle. But there's so many things, like Los Angeles, the United States, we are so reactive with everything instead of being preventative. And I think that we just need to move to a preventative system where we invest in our communities, we educate people, and Metro ambassadors do that. And why not? Why not? And we're employing our people and giving them a good living wage. And more people will use the transit then. So I know when I go down there and I see like 6 police officers, I actually feel less safe. I don't know about you, but I actually feel less safe. But that's as a Black and Latina woman, you know, that's I guess that's my opinion there.
Yeah, so I really hear a human-centered platform through your campaign. And I realize that folks need to hear about these kinds of positions on the issues because, first of all, they need to know that such positions exist. Now, it's also the case that there are at least 6 other candidates for this seat, 2 of whom have some pretty significant fundraising leads. Tell me a little bit, though, about what separates your campaign from these and why voters should keep that closely in mind as they fill out their ballots and go to the polls on Election Day come March 5th.
I love this question. I'm having a real, real good 2024. 2024 has been nice to me. We have reached matching funds, and that's the program where the city of Los Angeles matches any donation up to $129 6 times. So this week, I'm very proud to say I just deposited a check for $79,722. And so that was a game changer for my grassroots campaign. I am seriously, there is a can I say the word bastardization on here? There is a bastardization of the word grassroots progressive candidate. Okay. The other people are not it. I'm just going to say that. I'm going to be point blank honest. If you look at where they're getting their money from, they're taking money, prison money. They're taking police money. They're taking realtor money. They're taking all this special interest money. And I'm not. And that's why I haven't raised as much initially. So before this $79,000, we had $68,830-something in there. So we did all right. We did okay. It took us a little while because my people are artists. And who was affected by the strikes? The artists, they really were. And, you know, they came back around for us. So I'm not taking any money also from fossil fuel companies. So that's a lot of people I'm telling to keep their money to themselves. And so my goal is, you know, really to be a voice of the people. And I feel like the people see that it resonates with them. I show up. And that's one of the things that the other candidates do not do. They show up when it comes to a paycheck. I've shown up as a volunteer. I've shown up without expectation. I've shown up without strings attached. And, you know, I was on the strike lines. All year long, I was on the strike lines. I was delivering, you know, refreshments to them and then picking up a picket sign. So I've been out there with SAG-AFTRA. I've been out there actually since SEIU Local 99, all the way through SEIU UHW and all the locals in between. And I've also shown up at Sataquoy Elementary when the Bigots and the January Sixers and the Proud Boys came to you know, try to destroy LGBTQ rights and try to take us back. And I was out there with them. And I think that the community recognizes that. And they recognize that I am genuine and I'm of the people and I want to know what they think. So when I go and I knock doors and I say, what do you love about our community? What scares you about our community? People are so enlightened. They're like, wait a minute. You're the candidate, first off? Yeah, I'm the candidate. And they're like so refreshed that I'm out there knocking their door and that I am putting people to work to knock the doors. Because what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring love back to the Valley. The Valley has been so disenfranchised for so long. And we are telling them, you know what? It is time to say no to the corporate servants. It's time to say no to the big money. It's time to put in a public servant. Somebody who wants to serve the people because they love the people. And I absolutely love the people of CD2. And so that's why I'm running. And that's, you know, it shows. My work has started to show off. I've been endorsed by City Controller Kenneth Mejia, former mayor of Burbank, Constantine Anthony, current Culver City and first Black woman mayor, Yasmin Imani McCorrin. LA Forward was another big win for me. Streets for All was another big win. And today you are the first person that I'm telling that I have been endorsed by California Nurses Association.
Wow.
So I'm telling you, I'm having a good 2024, y'all. Like my work is starting to pay off. And also, oh, wait, I can't forget my people at IOTC, local B192 and California Women's List. So I have the organizations of people who are doing work on the ground. You may see other people having endorsements, but they're establishment endorsements. You know, they're endorsements that are looking for those backroom deals. And we need to say hell no, because the LA Fed tapes show that our district was gerrymandered for a certain candidate. And and that's starting to come to fruition. And he's calling himself a grassroots candidate. But if you look at his donations, it's dirty money. It is not a grassroots campaign whatsoever. And so I think, you know, this is the moment and we have to grasp it.
I appreciate so much all that you've said here. I appreciate that you are, as you said, not looking to take us back, but defending us against those who would, and seeing a path forward for us and walking a path forward for all of us to join you in, because this is a grassroots effort that can't stop, won't stop, certainly not given what you've described. Jillian, before we wrap up today, tell us a little bit about where to reach you, where to find out more, how folks can volunteer, how folks can donate, and we are set.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you so much, JT, for this opportunity. First off, I just want to say thank you to you. You can find me on all socials at Jillian, FORCD2. So I'm on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Blue Sky, Threads, all of those. Yeah, you can find me everywhere. So matching funds has been a game changer. And like I said, I'm having an amazing week because we got that check for $79,722 that I deposited this week. And it was able to help me exceed my expectations. I was able to hire more people than I thought I was initially going to be able to. Initially, we thought we were going to dedicate, you know, 20, maybe 30%. Of our funds towards staffing and hiring canvassers, but we were actually able to get closer to 40%. So we've hired 13 people and we just hired 3 more and we're still looking for people. So, you know, we're putting this money directly back into the community. So matching funds has been a game changer. And for those of you who don't know what it is, it's where the city matches any donation up to $129 6 times. So $129 becomes $774. So now that we've unlocked matching funds, it's not over yet. We still have, I like to call it Operation Max Out Matching Funds. So if we raise another like $15,000, we'll get $94,000 in additional funds. And, you know, it's a real game changer because a lot of people didn't take us seriously because we only had raised $68,000. And now we're over $100,000 with this additional $80,000. So we're about $140,000 and we get another $94,000. And if you look at it, you know, this is money that's coming from the community because again, I'm not taking any donations from corporations or special interests. And if you look at my opponents, it's not that way with them. They're taking that dark money, that special interest money, and they're going to be beholden to them. So they're not going to be public servants. They're going to be corporate servants. Whereas myself, I'll only be beholden to the people. And, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way. We are a people powered campaign. We are bringing love back to the valley. And we're bringing that message and really getting people ignited about this campaign and about voting for 2024, voting for change.
Absolutely, Jillian. And especially given all this, given the matching funds clause and the fact that you're using it to hire locally, that you're using it to send out postcards and all kinds of mailers, would you say that your campaign is actually what democracy in action looks like?
Absolutely, 100%. We are putting all the money back into the community. We're giving it back to the people. We're paying them a thriving wage as best as we can. And, you know, that's money that people wouldn't have had. People are struggling right now. And we're giving people who are on the strike lines a chance. We're giving people who have been unemployed and hurt by the COVID pandemic a chance. And it's exciting. It's exciting to see the momentum growing.
It really is. And given the journey leading up to this moment for you, I do have to say that I can only imagine how proud of you your community is nowadays, because my, oh my, this is what leadership and stepping up and really getting into that looks like as well. So Jillian, I want to congratulate you. I want to thank you for taking the time to chat with me on this installment of JT the Ellie Storyteller podcast. And I want to wish you as much rest as you can get, because I know that you are stumping out there. I know that you're hitting the ground running. So really, I appreciate you taking a pause from all the busy work you're up to for this conversation this evening.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, JT.
100%. Okay, this time it's saving, promise.
All good. But seriously, like, you know, like I said, I put on interactive shows and something always has to happen. Something always has to go wrong. And it's like, you know, that's entertainment. That's theater. That's what.
It's not an adventure until it goes wrong.
Right? Yeah.
Very cool. And just to be certain, your team is still in need of volunteers for those who are interested.
Always, always. Okay. So we have knocked about 18,000 doors so far, but we still need to knock more. I mean, you know, basically to win this election, we need to make sure we secure at least 18,000 votes. So if we've knocked 18,000 doors, we have to keep going. We need, our goal is to knock another 10 to 12,000.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. All right. Wear some comfortable shoes for us, please.
Yeah. And stay hydrated.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you again.
It's Jimbo times.